Welcome to...
And I'm Stephen Keller.
Stephen, not yet.
And I'm Stephen Keller.
You're stuck in a time loop, so be quiet.
And I'm Stephen Keller.
Stephen, shut up.
Oh, ow.
Welcome to episode 18, everyone. This is January 30th, if you're listening to it on release day, but even if you aren't, we're still coming to you live. We have a great episode, that's right, great. And as we're starting off with reactions to the Oscar nominations this year, and then we'll talk about a trivia question about the Oscars and be timely and everything. And then Stephen is going to wax long or maybe short about pans and tilts in our continuing Film Buffs Dictionary series about camera moves. And then comes our top six list, which is probably, I'm guessing, why Stephen was stuck in a time loop back there, because it's movies that play with time. And wrapping things up, we're going to close with another segment about sound, continuing off from the discussions from episodes 15 and 16. And I am Sam Stoddard.
I'm Stephen Keller, and I got one heck of a shiner. You hit me pretty hard there. I mean, why'd you hit me in the face, Sam?
That wasn't me.
Oh, was that your future self?
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
Gotcha.
Well, the Oscar nominations are in, and we've had a little time to digest them, so we're going to talk a bit about them. Stephen, what was the biggest surprise for you on Oscar nomination day?
Well, I think, like everyone else, it was the fact that Dreamgirls completely missed a Best Picture nod.
Yeah, Dreamgirls, a lot of people were saying, would win the thing. David Polin over at Movie City News was adamant that he was saying it was not a lock to win the Academy Award. He was just saying it was foolish to question that it would win the Academy Awards. I'm not sure what the difference in semantics was there.
Yeah.
But he was not even nominated. It's quite surprising. I think this is an unusual year. I think I think this is wide open. I really can foresee probably four out of the five Best Picture nominees actually going and winning. Not all of them at the same time, just any one of those four. I think The Queen probably isn't going to win it, but yeah, Babel is picking up steam. Little Miss Sunshine won the Producers Guild Award recently, and it's also one of the lighter comedies, so the dramas could theoretically split votes. The Departed has Martin Scorsese in the lead for Best Director still, probably, and Letters from Iwo Jima. who knows? I mean, nobody expected that to be nominated. I know we said it was one of the front runners on an earlier show, but then it sort of fell by the wayside, and now it just showed up out of nowhere after no guild nominations from the Writers Guild or Actors, Directors, or Producers Guilds. These are people that are all representative of the Academy, more or less, and it didn't show up anywhere, and then suddenly it's a Best Picture nominee.
Yeah, well, personally, I'm really just pulling for The Departed and Scorsese.
Yeah.
He really deserves to win one, finally, and The Departed is a great film.
So that's your choice for Best Picture and Director?
I hope.
Now, do you think it's going to win?
I do, but I should point out that I'm terrible at this predicting thing. So if I think it's going to win, probably it won't.
Well, I think Scorsese has a good chance, but I don't know. There's some strange things happening with Best Picture, and I'm actually not very good at that one. I have much better track records in other categories, strangely enough. Anyway, for actor, so DiCaprio was nominated for Blood Diamond and not The Departed. That's kind of odd, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I guess people were talking about it. I haven't seen Blood Diamond, so I'm not sure. I just didn't get the sense that it was that well-received of a film, but...
No, it wasn't. But two nominations from Blood Diamond. We have Jaimin Hansu for Best Supporting Actor from Blood Diamond. But yeah, not very well-received, and DiCaprio has this weird African accent that he's putting on in it. As for The Departed, people thought he'd be nominated for that, including me. Only Mark Wahlberg was nominated in Best Supporting Actor for The Departed. People thinking Jack Nicholson there as well. So only one nomination there. Is that the performance that should have been recognized from that movie?
Surprisingly, I actually think so. I think that's... you don't expect a whole great performance from Marky Mark Wahlberg, but he really does. I mean, his few scenes really steals every scene that he's in, which is just a really memorable, abrasive performance. It's great. You know, and Nicholson's performance... I don't know, it was good, but it was kind of bizarre and out there, and I get a sense people just think we've seen that from Nicholson before, so maybe that's why it goes underappreciated, even though it's still a good performance.
Yeah. Okay. Well, also in Best Actor, there's Ryan Gosling from a very little scene film, Half Nelson, and then the three that everybody was expecting and did wind up there: Peter O'Toole from Venus, Will Smith from Pursuit of Happiness, and Forrest Whitaker from The Last King of Scotland. And Whitaker's just sweeping the awards. But as we know, sometimes the Oscars go different when all these precursors line up, and then it just doesn't come through. I'm personally hoping that O'Toole makes it just because, you know. No, we're not supposed to do makeup type awards. People get annoyed when they say, "Oh, you didn't win before, so we give it to you this year." But it's Peter O'Toole.
Yeah, you know. He hasn't won like six times now.
It's seven. This is his eighth nomination. He has lost it seven times. If he loses this time, then no other actor will have lost as many.
Wow, I don't know if is that a good thing? Is that a good record to have or a bad one?
I don't know. And for that matter, Scorsese is in the same position. If he loses this year, then no director will have lost as many times as he has, who has never won one. So actress, the same lineup. It seems like this is the one category where everybody was in agreement. All the different award shows and the Oscars all went for the same five women: Penelope Cruz, Judi Dench, Helen Mirren, Meryl Streep, and Kate Winslet. There's probably not a whole lot to say there. I think Helen Mirren is pretty much a lock to win it, but we'll see. Supporting actor and actress are interesting. They're interesting categories. And what's interesting about actress, as we mentioned before, is Jennifer Hudson is in there, an American Idol finalist, and she's up against people like Kate Blanchett and some international stars and a 10-year-old newcomer. So, strange situation there. And an actor, there was a number of people. We mentioned Mark Wahlberg, Eddie Murphy from Dreamgirls. I mentioned Jaimin Hansu. And then there's Jackie Earle Haley from Little Children. He's one of these people that you probably recognize the face, even if you don't know the name. And Alan Arkin, an old veteran for Little Miss Sunshine. And you saw that movie. What did you think of him in it?
Oh, he was great. A wonderful performance, really. Of all the performances in that movie, far and away, his is the best and my favorite. You know, that's sort of an actor's movie, and he was just a... Yeah. There are people saying, well, Steve Carell should have been nominated. I totally disagree.
Yeah. Okay, so...
You know, one thing to me is that Borat got nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay. What?
That's a strange one.
What the heck was it adapted from, the TV show?
Adapted from Stream of Consciousness at the time of shooting?
I mean, there are some scenes in there which apparently were scripted. I mean, I don't think at this point no one's entirely sure how much of the movie was scripted, how much of it was improvised. But yeah, I mean, that seems like a weird choice to give it, a weird choice to nominate it for. Also, calling it adapted, I mean, I guess you can argue that it was based on the Borat character before, but... I mean, you know, it's not like an adaptation of a novel. It's certainly not, it doesn't take the plot of the TV show and expand it in a bigger scope or anything.
Right. The screenplay awards can be kind of strange. Someone, random place on the internet, but this is actually quite an interesting observation. The movie Annie Hall was basically rewritten in the editing room. And in the Academy Award time, it did not get a nomination for Best Editing, but it did get a nomination for Screenplay. And apparently, when you watch the movie, you don't see the screenplay. You see the editing composing the screenplay. So strange situations happen when you don't know how movies are made.
I guess that makes sense, and that probably explains Borat. And can I also complain about Randy Newman once again being nominated for the exact same song, for an allegedly original song for the worst part of Cars?
That's unfair.
It's just Randy Newman's song, number A, because it's the only one he's got. He's been nominated, like, what, 20 times now? I'm so sick and tired of having to listen to Randy Newman in every Pixar movie. And, I mean, especially because that scene just grinds that movie to a halt. We have to listen to get another terrible Randy Newman song. And, yeah, of course, Academy just gives him an Oscar nomination like they always do. Drives me crazy.
I think you're a bit more venomous about him than I am. I like his work. It's certainly, though, I can see a case for some more diverse musical styles. But Cars actually had it. Cars had quite a number of different types of music in it.
Yeah, but of course they picked the generic Randy Newman song to nominate.
Right. And for animated films, speaking of Cars, Cars made it, and Happy Feet made it. We were all expecting that. And then the third one was going to be sort of a... We thought there were going to be five, and then one of the eligible films was disqualified. And that put the total number under a key threshold. And so now, instead of five animated films, there's three. It's the rules are weird, but nobody quite knew what the third one would be. But Monster House made it, and that was a good choice, I think. I've seen it. It's quite a creative movie, much more inspired than any of the various wacky animals movies that we've had this past year. And then strange things in the minor categories, too. I won't go into detail, but a lot of technical categories and the artistic ones like art direction, costume design, and so forth did not go for Best Picture nominees. Now, often what happens is you get a few Best Pictures and they sweep the nominations. You get 11 nominations from this movie and 12 from this other movie, and they all dominate in the costume design and cinematography and all those, and then you have a few others filling the holes. But this time, several, I mean, I'd say half of the technical categories do not have any Best Picture nominees. Like cinematography, here's the list. Black Dahlia, Children of Men, The Illusionist, Pan's Labyrinth, and The Prestige. Very, very strange disconnect with the Best Picture lineup, but also insightful, too, because they're not just saying, oh, I love this movie, so let's nominate for everything. They're really, I think, thinking about these movies and saying, okay, well, these are the five best, but, you know, they might not have the five best makeup or costume or editing or whatever it is.
Yeah, far cry from years when Gladiator won visual effects and Chicago won editing.
Right. That was a strange situation. That was just wrong. But a lot of diversity, and even in the top categories, like this is the first time I believe this has ever happened since the very first Academy Awards. Best Actor, none of the nominees come from Best Pictures. Don't know why, it's just one of those years. So this is sort of what's interesting about tracking the Oscars, is finding out, you play the game of predicting the nominations or the wins, and then you are surprised sometimes. And in the changes that happen, you can sort of see a change in the tide of the way people think. So, closing thoughts?
Go Departed. Come on, it's gotta be Scorsese's. How can it not be?
Well, it wasn't five times before.
Yeah, but this is, you know, an allegedly wide-open field, right?
It is a wide-open field. Anybody could win. Anybody could win.
Also, but, let's just hope Babel doesn't, because the more I think about that movie, the more annoyed I am with it.
Really?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I have to say that I think has a pretty good chance. It's in the position Crash was in last year, where people knew about it, they were sort of up on it, but not really excited about it until the key moment when people were casting their ballots. And then suddenly people were excited about it. So, I mean, it won the Golden Globe. Not that the Golden Globes really mean anything, but, you know, it's suddenly very popular out of the blue.
So is there any way that An Inconvenient Truth does not win documentary?
No.
Okay.
But don't be so sure about Pan's Labyrinth for foreign film, because I'm just remembering Amelie from 2001. Amelie got a Best Foreign Language Film nomination and several others. It got five or six total nominations and did not win for whatever reason. And Pan's Labyrinth is in that situation now. It's one of the most nominated movies of all this year. Six nominations. I think Dreamgirls had eight, three of which are in the same category, Best Song. And then Babel had seven, and then there's a few ties for six. So it's up there. And it's not a Best Picture nominee, but it's foreign language film. And who knows, maybe they'll do the Amelie thing again and not pick the obvious choice there. So that brings us to the Oscar predictions games we've been running. The nominations game results are in, and the winner is somebody with a username JK Juice. Unfortunately for him and for the second and third place people, they did not listen to All Movie Talk episode 11 to get the prize code and make themselves eligible to win, so our special prize of the book Making Movies by Sidney Lumet goes to Trip Payne, coincidentally somebody that we mentioned before on this podcast. But congratulations, Trip, your prize is on the way. As for the next contest, which is to guess the winners of the Academy Awards, we've got even better prizes. This time we are giving prizes to the top three people who make themselves eligible to win our prizes by entering the code that we will give you in just a moment. All three of the top three players will receive a copy of Making Movies by Sidney Lumet, a great book. And in addition, Our second place winner will also receive a DVD, a movie that that person will be able to choose from a list that we will post on our website, allmovietalk.com. Just look for the show notes for this episode, and it's a selection of movies taken from our Best of the Year series that we've recently been airing here. And the first place winner will receive, in addition to the bookmaking movies, two movies taken from this list of movies. So definitely make sure that you enter the prize code when you go play the Academy Awards predictions game on Rinkworks. The prize code this time is Oscar, O-S-C-A-R. It's a singular form, not the plural, Oscar. You type in that into the appropriate space in the Academy Awards predictions game, and that will make you eligible to win one of these three prizes. Good luck. So to play the game, go to allmovietalk.com or rinkworks.com, rankworks.com. Both places will have a link to get you to the place where you gotta sign up and enter your guesses. For the 1944 Academy Awards, an actor was nominated in both the Best Actor and Best Supporting Actor categories for the same role in the same movie. This had never been done before or since, and the Academy revised its rules so it won't happen again. The question is to name the actor and the movie. Do you know what this is?
I might need some time.
Okay, it's ringing a bell. We'll give you about 45 minutes or so.
Okay. We're going to continue talking about camera movements in our Film Buffs Dictionary entry for this week, where we're going to cover pans and tilts. We've talked about ways in which the camera itself is physically moving along a path, but both pans and tilts are ways of moving the camera without actually moving it. We're only going to move along one axis now, and we're going to change what we're seeing without actually moving the base of the camera. So the first one is pan. And so imagine basically the camera is mounted on a tripod. Now the pan is simply our point of view, what we're seeing from the camera, is just going to move horizontally, but the base of the camera does not move. It's like standing very still and rotating your head, look left across your left shoulder, and then just slowly move your head over to your right shoulder, and there you just did a wide pan. The pan is very smooth, and it gives us sort of a more distant feel. If you want to track horizontal action, you know, characters walking down a road, let's say, you have a couple of ways of doing it. One, you could put the camera on a dolly or on track or something and move with the characters. And that's going to give you, like we've mentioned in those segments, a sense that you're there walking with the characters. On the other hand, if you just slowly pan with them, we feel a little more detached and distant. We feel like we're an observer away from them. And of course, you know, the pan is also used all the time just to track quick action, where you can't actually move the camera that fast, so you just move it really quickly. Especially movies that are trying to go for a documentary look will do this. Sometimes even you think of handheld, where the camera operator is going to hold still, but just swing the camera from one side to the other. That's also a sort of pan. And a tilt is very similar to a pan. It's like a pan, but we're looking up and down vertically. So imagine if you're standing still, look all the way up as far as your neck will go, and then slowly look down without moving your head to either side, and now you've just panned up and down. Same sort of idea. You're going to use it when you don't want to actually move the camera, because we don't actually change our perspective. So that's nice. When you change the camera where it's located spatially, you change perspective and focus. Here you're not doing that. And when you combine these especially, I mean, pans and tilts are most impressive when they're combined with other effects. Let's say you track along with somebody and then the camera stops and then you can keep panning, or you can pan to reveal things or tilt to reveal things. And so, you know, these of themselves aren't necessarily the most interesting and flashy camera moves. They're more subtle, which is nice. So if you want to show something without drawing a lot of attention to it, pans and tilts can be a good way of doing it. But it's definitely something that you'll hear a lot about. If you ever read scripts, sometimes script direction will say, you know, pan left, or, you know, we pan to see this. So that's what they're talking about when you see this sort of thing.
My favorite pan, by the way, is at the end of Nine Lives, a recent movie, but it's a 360-degree pan around, and I can't tell you the significance of it without kind of ruining it, but that's just a great use of a pan that does draw attention to itself, a sort of extreme form. Steven, what's even better than a top five list?
What about a list that went one higher?
What about a list that we do out of order?
Out of order? That'd be tricky.
Yeah, why don't we just go in order? But it would be appropriate if we went out of order, because this week our list is about movies that play with time. Most of us experience life in chronological order, and similarly, most movies are told chronologically, but movies give you a freedom that life does not. and they allow you to experience a story out of order. Why would you do that? Well, maybe we'll see when we see what some of these titles are. But, you know, sometimes it turns out that mixing up time results in a more satisfyingly told story. Like, if there's a secret that a character knows at the beginning, maybe it'd be better if you don't know it until the end and you come back to it later. But the ground rule here for this list is we're not going to include any movies that have time travel in it. That's a different list that we will probably do at another time. So there's no time travel, it's just movies that play with the time within a story. So let's get started. My number six, paradoxically, is told in chronological order, but it plays with time in that it takes place in real time. That is, for every minute that goes by as you watch the movie, 1 minute elapses within the movie itself. The movie is called Nick of Time, and it's a fun little Hitchcockian thriller from 1995 starring Johnny Depp. Now, real-time movies are not new, but Nick of Time is all about the time. It's a race-against-the-clock thriller. Something bad is going to happen soon, and Johnny Depp has to figure out how to stop it from happening before it's too late. We're always looking at clocks and watches and observing how long things take, and I think that makes it work a little better than the average race-against-the-clock movie, because usually you can do some editing tricks to allow you to jump around and buy the hero some time whenever he needs it. Because with most of these movies, in reality, the hero always has just the right amount of time that he needs, and of course in this one as well. But if you let the editing pull tricks, like you show us a countdown on a bomb that reads, you know, I don't know, 10 seconds, and we cut away, show some action for 10 seconds, and cut back, and it's only at 8 seconds left, and so we're always buying our hero time. Well, it doesn't happen here. This movie, real time is movie time, and so it's not quite as disorienting. It's a lot stronger for playing fair.
Sure. And of course, as we all know, the best time to defuse a bomb is when there's just 10 seconds left. Well, my number six pick is a Tarantino movie, and it's probably not the Tarantino movie you think I would pick if you've listened to anything I've ever said about movies before. Instead, it's Tarantino's first real feature film, Reservoir Dogs, from 1992. A lot of Tarantino's movies, three of the four that he's done, have been nonlinear, but when I saw Reservoir Dogs for the first time, I didn't really know what to expect, and I was just blown away by the way it jumps all over time. It's in fact very shocking, the way the narrative is so nonlinear. The opening scene is these crooks sitting around a diner just sort of talking before they're about to pull off a big heist job, and then they walk out, and we see sort of the title sequence, and then we cut to they're fleeing the heist job, and one of them's been shot, and another one's driving them, and everything's gone to hell, and we're really confused as things jump around, and it's so disorienting, but so cool. And, you know, I don't think that Reservoir Dogs is necessarily a great movie, but it definitely sort of paved the way for the Tarantino style, and it works out interesting. I think it definitely takes a fairly conventional story, and the way it jumps all over the place in such shocking and abrupt ways makes the story a lot more fun than it would have been otherwise.
Interesting. I definitely would have thought you'd pick Pulp Fiction before this one, and also Kill Bill, for that matter, which I think tells a story in a pretty interestingly jumbled way. A lot of flashbacks and jumping around and everything.
But I just went back to Reservoir Dogs because it was really the first time Tarantino had done it. And so I just thought it'd be cool to cite that one, since everyone would expect me to pick those other ones, since they're actually better films.
Yeah, well, my number five, I was fully expecting you to pick Pulp Fiction, and so I said, well, I'm just going to let you talk about this one later. My number five is Pulp Fiction, though, and I guess I have to talk about it. Pulp Fiction, it jumbles up time in a really cool way. What do you think about that?
Wow, I think it's neat. Pulp Fiction is interesting because it's also sort of a series of interlocking stories, but then cut around narratively. In fact, in another person's story, we see one of the characters get killed, but then we go back and we see him before he gets killed, too. And that's sort of startling, because you think, oh, he's done with the movie. And then you kind of realize how everything fits together at the very end when all the stories have really tied together.
Right. An important thing to observe about this movie is it's not just jumbled time. You can't straighten it out so it's told chronologically, because there's certain scenes, not too many, but a certain key scenes that are shared between different stories, and we see them one time from one perspective, and then the same scene later on with different characters, and then the second time through we see how they interlock. You can't reorder those scenes chronologically because they take place during each other, and it just wouldn't make any sense if you're cutting back and forth. So you had to play with time to make this movie work.
Yeah, it's not at all a gimmick. Well, my number five movie is a little interesting, too, and I'm not 100% certain all of it qualifies, though it is a little technically non-linear, but it's the relentlessly clever 2004 film Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind by director Michel Gondry. It's a great, great script by screenwriter Charlie Kaufman, and it's a movie about memories, and much of the film has Jim Carrey stuck in his own memories as they're being erased by this fangled technology machine that can erase your memories, because he's trying to remove the memories of his lover after he's broken up with her, and then he decides, as he's conscious through this process and decides he doesn't actually want to lose them, so he starts retreating back into his own past, and the movie sort of circles around and around and around in his own head. And you know what? That might not be technically playing with time. The outside narrative, outside of all those scenes inside of Carrie's head, is also a little bit, not too much, but a little bit nonlinear as well. It's very, very subtle the way the movie does play around with time. I think one of the very early scenes actually takes place toward the very end of the film's chronology. But it's just a constantly visually inventive movie, and just definitely has a lot to say about loss and love and memories and whether or not it's worth it to remember experiences that are wonderful but hurt because you have those memories.
Actually, that was my number four pick, so you didn't do one I thought you'd do, and you did one that I didn't think you did. But, yeah, Eternal Sunshine is a fascinating movie. It's definitely weird. You have to be open-minded to it. If you're conventionally minded, you just want to see a conventional movie, this is the last one you want to watch. But it's so inventive, and I love how, within the memories, we bounce around in time a lot, and piece by piece, we gradually come to an overall understanding of his life and why he loves this woman in the first place. It's just a lot of fun and very entertaining.
Absolutely. Well, my number four movie is on a completely different subject. I have no clever segue here. It's Godfather 2 from 1974, directed by Francis Ford Coppola. And what's interesting about it, because today it seems fairly conventional, and if you just think about it, it seems sort of conventional, because most of the movie takes place linearly, except there's this flashback thread that's sort of cut through it, and that's not too uncommon, until you start to realize that the flashback, that character's not actually in the main narrative. He's not in the main thread. It's not really a flashback at all, but a completely separate storyline that takes place in the past that will sort of, kind of, indirectly influence the events in the present, but for the most part, it's another story that serves more to flesh out what we're understanding, to drive home the themes, without connecting directly to the main story. And that's pretty uncommon in the movies, especially then, and even now, you don't see a lot of that.
Yeah, it's a very strange structure to it, to have these two different threads that are unrelated in a movie that's not about all kinds of different stories. Sometimes you have a movie that's just clearly about a bunch of different stories, but no, this is a real strong story centered on a single character, and then we have these digressions to another single character. Well, for my number three, I picked a movie that should really be number one, but as always, I try to order these lists primarily by how well the movies fit the theme, not just, you know, how good is the movie. So, anyway, my number three, therefore, is Citizen Kane, the 1941 directorial debut of Orson Welles. It's often said to be the greatest film of all time. We start at the very end of the life of Charles Foster Kane, hear his dying word, and then we follow a young reporter as he interviews people in Kane's life and tries to track down the meaning of this last word that he said upon dying. So he meets with his old associates and women that he's had relationships with, and they tell the stories of their peace. They tell what they know about this man, Kane. And, of course, that's all out of order. We jump back and forth from the beginning to the end of the beginning to the end of Kane's life. And it's a remarkably effective way to tell this story. It could very easily have been done as a traditional biopic, progressing more or less chronologically, but I think a movie like that would have been forgotten. This way, only seeing snippets of his life as we go, and following not Kane around as the main character, but really this young reporter, we are then able to piece together a fuller and fuller picture of the man without ever losing our sense that we don't have the whole story. Even by the end, there's a mystery about this man, Kane, that we'll just never be able to fully comprehend.
Yeah, and definitely the structure of the movie gives it more depth. Every time you go back and watch it, you pick up new things, you sort of understand it better and better, and I think it's one of the reasons why it's appreciated so much throughout the years, because there is so much to study and really take away from it the more you look at it. I think definitely the structure helps it out. Well, my number three movie is a more obvious pick for this list, and that's the 1998 film Run, Lola, Run by director Tom Tykwer. It's a great German film that tells more or less the story in real time that takes about 20 minutes. Then we go back to the start of the story and tell it again, only things have slightly changed, and we see how these little tiny changes completely influence the rest of the movie. And then we go back and do it again. So we end up getting these three run-throughs of this 20-minute segment that takes place in real time, and the main character is this woman who's trying to come up with 100,000 marks to give to her boyfriend before this mobster kills him or something like that. And basically the big thing that changes at the very beginning is how quickly she's able to get out of her house and start moving, and you know, she doesn't trip over this kid, and so then the entire rest of the 20-minute arc is completely changed. And there's even some interesting things where she'll run into somebody on the street, and we'll see all these real quick flash forwards of where this person's life is going to go from here. And in each of the three, they turn out to be completely different because she interacts with them slightly different. It's that sort of theory where, you know, the small changes equal big huge consequences way down the line. And it's such an interestingly put together movie, very, very well edited and shot, and just has this hyperkinetic feel that's a lot of fun. And one thing that was interesting is Sam, we were talking about the rules for this list. Sam was like, well, you can't pick Run, Lola, Run because it's a time travel movie and we weren't picking time travel movies. But in fact, in Run, Lola, Run, there is no real time travel. She's not going back in time so much as we're just seeing a different take on that story, a different way it could have been. There is maybe one or two moments where it seems like maybe she realizes that she's done this before, but I don't think that quite counts because it's hard to tell. I don't think it's at all a traditional time travel movie.
Yeah, I think I'm going to concede the point on that one. I stayed away from it because I really wasn't sure, especially at the end of each of these 20-minute run-throughs of the story. There's a question about whether she kind of knows that it's going to happen again. I don't know. I just stayed away from it just to be safe, but I love the movie, and I love how it really illustrates in a very compelling and entertaining way how these little tiny things, and just be a little bit different in space or time, can have huge impacts. I mean, I sometimes think about that just when I'm walking on a sidewalk next to a busy road. I think, you know, I could be 1 foot over here and die, but now I'm on the curb, and so I'm safe. It's just, it's really weird how sensitive space and time is to our safety, our lives, everything. And this movie is just a great exploration of that. My number two film is Stanley Kubrick's The Killing from 1956. It's a riveting, really tightly edited chronicle of a heist at a racetrack, and it does a wonderful job of giving us the sense of this complex heist plot where a bunch of different characters are all doing things concurrently. And it does that by bouncing around in time a bit. With each scene, the narrator gives us the time, and we follow a character through some part of the operation, and then the next part may or may not be something that immediately follows. Maybe after doing his bit, somebody else doesn't come through for him, and later we eventually get back to that other character and figure out what went wrong. It's a very interesting way to tell the story. Sounds complicated, kind of is, but it's a very easy movie to follow, too. But it's done in a really fascinating way for this kind of story.
Yeah, so that was one I've heard about, but I haven't actually seen it, so I couldn't pick it, though, definitely.
Get it.
I need to. Well, my number two pick is another pretty obvious one. I'll be surprised if it's not your number one, and it's a movie we've talked about before in depth. We keep going back to Christopher Nolan, but here it is, his 2000 film Memento, the backwards movie about a man looking for the person who may or may not have killed his wife, but the guy can't actually create any new long-term memories, so he doesn't remember anything he was doing a few minutes ago, and so we watch the entire movie backwards, except for some scenes, which we watch forwards. And anyway, twisted chronology, great film, very psychologically compelling, and an interesting portrait of how memory influences us, and just a wonderful crime picture with some interesting plot twists.
Well, my number one movie that plays with time, that isn't a time travel movie, is Memento, a 2000 thriller by Christopher Nolan. Steven, I think you jumped ahead in time and heard me say that and jumped back. What do you think?
Yeah, obviously that's... Well, I didn't jump ahead in time, rather the narrative jumped ahead, but I have access to that because this is...
Oh, excellent.
This is a meta story. I'm aware that I'm in a movie right now.
Okay. Well, the only thing I have to add about that, you did a good job summing it up, but usually when movies manipulate time, they break away from how we experience life, and there's a cost to that. Maybe what you gain for jumping around in time is something more than the cost of shattering, you know, the way we would relate to the same story if we were in it. But this is an example of how a movie manipulates time and tells things out of order in order to more closely reflect real experience, specifically of this character who can't remember what he's done. So he doesn't know what he's just done. We don't know what he's just done either, because the story is told backwards. And so I just think that's really fascinating that we've jumbled up the timeline in order to better reflect a character's experience.
It's absolutely very interesting. Well, my number one pick, you already took, and it's Citizen Kane from 1941 by Wells, and I think it fits this list very, very well. And also because at the time, in 1941, this was such an unexpected and interesting original way to tell a story. It's so complex, the way that we see everything so out of order, and there's this one, like you say, the moving forward story where we have the reporter interviewing people trying to piece together his life, but then when all the stories that people are telling are completely out of order. And I think film critic Roger Ebert has said that he's watched the movie, you know, 100 times or whatever, but he's never been able to place all the events firmly in his mind, and you can't quite remember which scene's going to come next or what happened when. And I agree, absolutely. Every time I watch it, I'm surprised because there's just stuff I've just completely forgotten, or that I think, okay, this is what's coming up next, and again, completely surprised. And it's just, you really couldn't tell this movie straightforward, like you said, Sam. If you tried, it would have been forgotten. But there's just such a richness to the way it works. I really gotta say, if you've only seen Citizen Kane once, you haven't really seen it. I know the first time I saw it was when I started really getting interested in movies, and I thought, okay, I have to watch this. And I rented it and I watched it, and I thought, well, that wasn't anything that special. I guess it was good, but every time I watch it, I just appreciate it more and more. And I think it's absolutely because of that structure that gets in and stays with you. And if you think about it, that's almost how we remember people's lives, sort of out of order. You think of things that matter to you, and you think of those, they have the most prominence. You know, your memories aren't entirely chronological so much as arranged in your head in order of importance. The things that matter to you the most are the things that are freshest in your head. And I think there's just something about Kane that captures that very well.
Yeah, I agree with you about not just seeing it one time. When I saw it the first time, I also thought, I don't know. I think I just realized that I wasn't getting it all. I liked it, but I saw it a second time and maybe appreciated it a little more, but still was a little confused. And it wasn't until the third time I saw the movie that I realized, now I get it. And since then, I've, you know, as a rule, I don't rewatch movies. I'd much rather, given the choice, watch something I haven't seen before. But this one I've seen several times. I've also seen the very excellent Roger Ebert commentary on the latest DVD release. But yeah, I've seen it several times, and just every time there's something new to observe. Oh, I didn't realize that little piece of whatever going on in the background. Or I think I got to go back to what I was saying about how his life is still a little bit of a mystery. We do learn a lot about him. I don't want to say it's open-ended or unsatisfying, but there's still a mystery. It's like if you see a great man from afar, and not that he was necessarily a great man. He was certainly of large stature socially and politically and everything, but you look at a great man from afar, and you might understand him, but how much you do, there's always a sense that there's something a little elusive that you'll never really understand about what makes him the way he is. And we really get that sense about Kane, whereas in the traditional biopics, I think they try to spell out too much.
Absolutely. So shall we recap?
Sure. Yeah, let's talk about my list. Number 6 is Nick of Time, the thriller from 1995 starring Johnny Depp. Number 5, Pulp Fiction from 1994, which Steven did not include. Number 4, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind from 2004. Number 3, the great movie Citizen Kane from 1941. Number 2 is The Killing from 1956 by Stanley Kubrick. Kubrick's first great movie, in fact. And number 1, Memento from 2000.
And my top 6 list of movies that play with time but aren't actually time travel movies. Number 6, Reservoir Dogs by Quentin Tarantino from 1992. Number 5, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind from 2004 by director Michel Gondry, with a special nod to screenwriter Charlie Kaufman. Number 4, The Godfather Part 2 from 1974 by Francis Ford Coppola. Number 3, Run Lola Run, the 1998 German film by director Tom Tykwer. Number 2, Memento from 2000 by Christopher Nolan. And number 1, Orson Welles' debut film in 1941, Citizen Kane.
For the past weeks, we've been talking about Hollywood's transition from silent movies to sound movies, and we'll conclude this series by talking today about the artistic differences between silence and sound. Obviously, sound is a big thing, a powerful tool for conveying information. So if you have it, there's room for great artistry in its use. And if you don't have it, you may have to use some great artistry to convey in other ways the information you might otherwise convey with sound quite naturally. We did talk a little bit about this last week, so let's continue that discussion. To set the tone for this week, I want to quote from an article I find absolutely fascinating. It's an article written in 1929, right at the dawn of the sound era, by director René Clair, who is considered one of the great directors, but he's best known for movies he hadn't made by this time, the early musical comedies Le Million and A Nous la Liberté, both from 1931. So obviously these are going to be musicals. These are definitely very dependent on sound. And later he moved to Hollywood and made some fondly remembered comedies and the great Agatha Christie adaptation And Then There Were None. But before any of this, in 1929, he wrote this fascinating essay on the coming of talkies, and besides how well written it is, it expresses a very revealing perspective about how filmmakers perceived the talkie era at the time it was just beginning. We'll put a link to this article in full on our website, allmovietalk.com, but in summary, it touches upon the art of filmmaking with and without sound. And interestingly, it makes a rigid distinction between what they called sound films and talkies. This is a distinction we just don't make today. But basically, sound films are films with pre-recorded, synchronized music and sound effects, and talkies are films where you have spoken dialogue throughout. Of course, many early sound movies were a hybrid between the two, but the distinction here is that with sound films, there's not necessarily a dependence on the dialogue. But anyway, René Clair just seemed to just hate the idea of talkies while loving the freedom that sound gives you, inasmuch as he acknowledges that the value of sound as spectacle was wearing off as one film after another resorted to showing off the same sorts of sound effects, like a ticking clock and car engines and so on. A lot of early sound movies are really blatant about showing off, including scenes designed pretty much just to have some neat sounds that would dazzle the audiences of the day who had not heard this stuff from the movies before. But he sees the potential for artistry and cites the movie Broadway Melody, which actually won the Best Picture Oscar in 1929, and this is a talkie, but one with an artful use of sound effects, such as a moment when we zoom in on the face of an anguished woman looking out a window, and we hear a car door closing and the car driving off. Now, see if you can imagine this. The camera is just steady on the face of this anguished woman watching someone leave. We hear someone get in the car and drive off, but what we see is just this face. The focus of the scene, and therefore our attention, is on the character. We get the story sort of peripherally. Now, in a silent movie, you wouldn't be able to do this. You'd have to cut away from the woman and show the guy getting in the car and driving off, and then cut back to the woman. Otherwise, how would you know what this woman is all upset about seeing? Well, by doing these cuts, you get the story across, but it takes the viewer's attention off the character, and it just wouldn't quite be as powerful a moment. Interestingly, though, René Clair ultimately doesn't see much use for voices, at least at this time. Let me read his conclusion about talkies real quick. By its variety of sounds, its orchestra of human voices, it does give an impression of greater richness than the silent cinema. But are such riches not, in fact, quite ruinous to it? Through such quote-unquote progressive means, the screen has lost more than it has gained. It has conquered the world of voices, but it has lost the world of dreams. I have observed people leaving the cinema after seeing a talking film. They might have been leaving a music hall, for they showed no sign of the delightful numbness which used to overcome us after a passage through the silent land of pure images. They talked and laughed and hummed the tunes they had just heard. They had not lost their sense of reality. And this provides me with a good segue into an important thing I wanted to try to express, and that is, silent movies have a potential that the addition of sound absolutely destroys. We don't tend to watch silent movies much today, and it's sort of a vicious circle because since we don't watch them, we're not used to watching them and don't necessarily understand how they can be powerful in a way that talkies cannot. I mean, I think if you ask the average person on the street, hey, have you ever seen a silent film? Are you interested? You know, there's going to be some confusion. Why would I watch that? We have sound now. Earlier in this podcast, in episode 3, in fact, way back to episode 3, we talked about how sometimes black and white is more effective at establishing certain kinds of moods than color is. And I think this is probably quintuply true of silent over sound. I'm not saying spoken dialogue doesn't have its place, or even that its place isn't the majority of the time. But if you watch one of the great silent movies and let it absorb you, there's this incredibly mesmerizing, dreamlike feel that can overcome you, and much like René Clair says, you can lose your sense of reality and become lost in the imagery in a way that you cannot with a sound film. And if you're not used to watching silent movies, it could maybe take a few to get used to it. There is a transition. You have to get used to what this is. It's sort of odd the first time you see a silent movie, maybe. You're sitting in the room and there's no sound. You're just watching the TV. It's like somebody muted it or something. It's kind of weird.
Well, hopefully the movie you're watching has a musical soundtrack.
Even if it has the musical soundtrack, it's sort of odd. It's just a weird feeling. And for me, it took, two or three different silent movies other than the comedies. The comedies, I think, a little more watchable than the dramas, but... You know, it takes a few to get used to it, but ultimately the potential is to experience a feeling from the movies that you just cannot get anywhere else. The moment people talk in a tangible, realistic way, the movie grounds you. It anchors you to reality in some sense, but the silence can just sweep you up and carry you off. I don't know how to explain it better than that. It's the sort of thing you have to work out for yourself.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned this, because this was what I wanted to talk about as well. You're right, it is this weird sort of mesmerizing hypnotic state. And you know what I would liken it to is like seeing a concert. Because we listen to music a whole lot, but it's very rare that you just sit down and do nothing but listen to music. But if you go to a concert, essentially what you're doing is for a couple of hours doing nothing but listening to music and watching people play it. And after a little while, you get in this weird state where you're just really focused on the music and the sound and all the experience. And it's just something that you're not used to necessarily. I mean, I pretty much never put on an album and just sit there listening to it. I'm almost always doing something else while I'm listening to music. And in much the same way, silent films, when you're watching them, you're focused almost entirely on the imagery. Normally when we watch movies, there's lots of distractions on the soundtrack. There's people talking, we hear all the sound design, it's wonderful, but it feels fairly realistic. When you're just watching images, you really go into this other state where after a while, like you said, I agree, it does take a while to get into it. It's hard to do. You have to really want to do it in order to be able to do it. But once you get into it, you really sort of get into that zone where you're focused on the images and you really begin seeing it for what it is. And that's neat, because movies, we forget often, are really first and foremost a visual medium. And when you stop paying attention, when you stop having to pay attention to all the other stuff around you, the sound and the talking, and you just focus on the images, it's amazing how much more you kind of appreciate it.
Yeah, and of course there are good silent movies and bad silent movies, just like anything, but, you know, if you take some of the great silent movies and the effect they've had on me, I think René Clair described it to a T. You really lose your sense of reality, and it's something I've never gotten ever from a sound film. I've definitely had a lot of sound films I've admired and have taken me to some place I've never been before, but you can go to different places and the silence would seem to have an effect that the sound just doesn't. Is dreamlike the right word? I mean, do we ever really hear sounds in dreams, or just the impression? I said this about color. I said you don't ever really see colors. You see the impression of colors in dreams. Is the same true for sound?
Maybe, certainly possibly. One thing I think is kind of sad is, you know, we talked about in color and black and white, that black and white films are still being made. Silent films are not. Silent films really did die. They're an entirely lost art. I know there are a couple of, you know, some experimental silent films that have been made recently, but those are in the incredible exception. You know, these days we're getting, you know, one or two big profile black and white movies each year, it seems like, and exactly zero big profile silence, which is really sad. I know we've talked about a lot on the show before, because we both really appreciate The Passion of Joan of Arc. And I think that's a great example of that movie, which is all about these faces and these images, could never, ever work in a sound film. It requires the silent, like you said, this dreamlike quality, this hypnotic, mesmerizing experience where you just get really, really tuned into the rhythms of the images themselves.
That's a good way to put it, the rhythms of the images, because it's not the story it's telling. The story is easily summed up in one sentence and is covered by other movies that aren't nearly so interesting. But there's no real exposition. It's just a flow.
Yeah, it gets you into the psychology of it. What's interesting is, because there is no need for synchronized sound, I think one of the interesting things is to play different music as a soundtrack for a silent movie. Of course, the Criterion edition of The Passion of Joan of Arc, the DVD, and I think I've seen it on broadcast on Turner Classic Movies the same way, has a score that was done specifically for that film, but it was done much, much after the film's release. The film was originally intended to be released without any musical accompaniment at all. And it's interesting, if you can watch it both ways, obviously with or without that musical operatic soundtrack. And it's really interesting how it affects your perception of the movie. I personally prefer the score that's available on the DVD. I think it really heightens the experience. But it is interesting how that change really affects your mood. I remember in college, I was talking with a friend of mine. He was talking about when he watched, I think it was Metropolis in a film class, a great science fiction film. And he said, well, he was there watching it, and he had his little portable CD player. You can tell I went to college a little while ago because this wasn't an MP3 player, but his portable CD player and his headphones, and he slipped on some of his own like weird German techno music or something, and it really just put him in exactly the right state. And he normally didn't really like silent films, but that time, because he was like zoned in on it, it worked perfectly for him. And I think that's definitely an interesting experience. It might be worth it. If you don't really like silent movies that much, or you're afraid of watching them, try putting one in and getting your own music that works for you, that puts you in the right mood to see the particular movie that you're watching. I think it's an interesting experiment to try out.
You probably do have to be careful about matching it, though. I don't know. I'm a little suspicious of that. I definitely support it if it's going to get people to watch silent movies. The best time I ever had with The General, though, the Buster Keaton film, was with no music at all. I have not heard a score that sounded better than nothing. For some reason, the comedy just works better if you don't have the music kind of distracting you with its own rhythms. Even the scores that are written for the movie, I haven't liked. So that's kind of odd, actually, when you think about it. But
yeah, it is interesting. I was fortunate enough to see Nosferatu once with a live orchestra.
Oh, excellent.
And that's a real interesting experience, because, of course, that's how you're supposed to see these. That's right. How they were originally intended to be seen. And if you ever get the chance, there are a few theaters. I saw this up at a university that was doing it, sort of like a special exhibition. But there are actually a couple theaters that will occasionally do this sort of thing. And if you ever get the chance to see a silent film with a live musical score, that's wonderful. But I think you can. You can sort of pick and choose what you want to see with it, because, of course, back when silent films were being released, a lot of times, if you're seeing it in a small town, you had a guy with a piano, and maybe he had the score that was intended for the movie, and maybe he was just making it up as he went along. That was pretty common.
Yeah.
So certainly there's a tradition of replacing the music that maybe, like Chaplin wrote scores for his movies. But I don't think there's anything wrong with necessarily putting in your own music or finding music or turning it off entirely if that's what works for you. Silent films are kind of adaptable that way.
So, at some point, we're going to talk about some good silent movies to start with if you are interested in getting into it. Some are definitely going to be more accessible than others. Some are probably not very accessible. As much as I love The Passion of Joan of Arc, I'm not sure that that's a good one to start with.
Yeah, I agree.
But definitely the comedies, until we get to listing some different things, Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin, I mean, there's a reason why these people are still popular today. And if you do want something a little more modern, if you must, I think going back to what you said earlier, the silent movies don't get made anymore. There is one that I know of that has any kind of profile whatsoever, and that is the Mel Brooks comedy from 1976 called Silent Movie. And there is no dialogue. It is a sort of a mimicry of classic silent comedies. There is one word spoken in it, but it is spoken by Marcel Marceau in a really nice reversal of things.
Other movies to get you started might be interesting. I think if you're to watch a movie that is partially sound, partially silent, might be a good way to go. Hitchcock's Blackmail.
Sure.
Is an interesting crime movie, and it'll walk you into it a little bit. Or maybe Fritz Lang's film M, which actually has sound throughout pretty much the entire film, but has long periods of extended silence, and that's a really interesting way to sort of get you into it, because, of course, Long directed many great silent films as well.
Including Metropolis, which is another one that may be a good one to go to.
Yeah, and the other good thing to look for might be some of these silent shorts, because then you're not committing yourself to it, and even though it's worth noting that the silent feature is only an hour long, usually maybe a little bit longer than usually a full hour and a half, like think of a feature today, but Chaplin and Keaton shorts are available, and if you watch those, they're very funny, and you're not committing yourself the entire time, you just watch a little bit at a time, and it's maybe a little bit easier. One thing I might mention, too, is I think for a lot of people, Buster Keaton is going to be a little bit more accessible than Chaplin, because Chaplin has that tendency to get a little too syrupy. And the sentimentality back in the 10s and the 20s was a little bit different than it is today. It was a lot more acceptable to go a little more overboard, I think, than where we would go today. I mean, if you watch D.W. Griffith films, there's that always those weird, very Victorian-esque endings where everyone's up in heaven as angels. And it's very strange. We would never accept that today. So I think Keaton's a little more understated, he's the great stone face.
It's much more focused on physical comedy.
Right, less melodrama.
And all that sort of thing that does translate to today very well, yeah.
But you can't go wrong with either one. I think probably avoiding the great silent dramas is a good way to get started. You don't want to go try and watch all 8 hours of Greed. Though sadly, of course, no one can because they don't exist. But and of course, there's some other movies that are worth looking at and paying attention to how they play with sound. We mentioned Hitchcock and Blackmail, but also The Birds is an interesting movie because of the fact that it's one of the few thrillers that has no musical score. There is some music in the movie, but it all comes from like a record player or a band, that kind of thing. There's no actual just music that comes from nowhere in the movie. And so if you watch that, and if you've seen it, if you watch it again, and particularly pay attention for the way it uses sound.
Oh, the sound of those birds terrifies me to this day.
Yeah, it's very effective. We're sort of talking about the artistic uses of sound. I think particular thrillers overuse sound, that the muted soundtrack, just breathing or just footsteps or just bird wings flapping, can be much more effective at being creepy than a lot of loud piano stings and overbearing music.
Yeah, that's interesting that you said that, because that reminded me of a total left field jump into the animated films of Hayao Miyazaki. And he is very interested in flight. It's a strange thing. Almost all his movies have something to do with flight, whether it's a witch on a broom or a character who can ride on a giant bird.
Or a castle in the clouds.
They're always flying. And during the flight sequences, you tend not to hear too much in the way of music. What you hear only is the wind just brushing past people, and you really get the sense of what it's like to be up in the air and flying. And there's a real, you can't see the air, but you can see its effect on the hair and clothes and stuff, and you hear the sound of the wind rushing by. It's so effective and exciting. So great use of sound there that you reminded me of, kind of, when you talked about the thrillers.
So yeah, and we'll have more discussion about this on our website, more ideas if you're interested in giving silent films a try. I know certainly some people in our black and white discussion back in episode 3 were like, you guys are just being pretentious hacks. And if that was your reaction to black and white, boy, I'm going to just tell you to go and stay away from silent films. But if you're interested in giving a shot and expanding your film horizons, silent films are a great place to go because, for almost, basically 30 years, they were making great silent movies, and it's really worth checking a lot of them out.
So, earlier in the podcast, we asked a question about the 1944 Academy Awards, and an actor was nominated in both the Best Actor and Supporting Actor categories for the same role in the same movie. And so, some people thought he was a supporting actor, and others thought he was a lead. This won't happen again, because now the Academy will only accept you as eligible in one or the other. But it happened in 44, and the question is to name the actor and the movie. So, Stephen, you said you needed some time, and you've had about 45 minutes, right? So, what do you think a guess is?
I don't know. It's in the back of my head, but I don't know what it is.
You're going to recognize it when I tell you?
I know.
Okay, well, I'll tell you. The answer is Barry Fitzgerald for the movie Going My Way, where he starred a priest. And he's an Irish actor, played the part of an Irish priest, but this was opposite Bing Crosby, who was the lead. And so, despite splitting his votes across double nominations, he did actually win the Best Supporting Actor Oscar. And later on, he broke the head off it while practicing his golf swing. Oops.
That's why you don't swing golf clubs indoors.
Yeah, exactly. You might break your Oscar. That's it for episode 18, but next week we have episode 19. But in the meantime, go to our website, allmovietalk.com, and join in the discussion there, and tell us what you think. Tell us what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong, what we should be doing different. Give us some suggestions, and talk about what we've talked about. And also check out Rinkworks, rinkworks.com, with a whole bunch of movie-related features and other sorts of entertainment stuff.
And, of course, check us out next Tuesday, which will be February 6th. We're going to have, of course, a great episode for you. We're going to discuss German Expressionism, debut a new segment where we'll discuss some great Hollywood myths that may not be myths. And we'll also have a top six list, of course, and that list is going to be about the top six uses of music in movies that are not musicals. This will be great musical moments in movies that are not specifically all about music.
Cut! All right, that just didn't make any sense at all. We're going to do it again, and we're going to do it again and again, and we're going to stay here all night if we have to. We're not going home until it makes sense, or my name isn't David Lynch.